Well, we're in Matthew chapter 18. If you can find your way there. Matthew 18 is a chapter that is very important and at times woefully misunderstood. And we'll deal with some of that as we get our way down through here. We begin in verse 1, of course, on chapter 18 of Matthew's Gospel. It says, "At that time the disciples came to Jesus saying, 'Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?'" Not an unanticipated question, really. The disciples are, they are very much aware of how the kingdoms of the world work. They're familiar with history. They're also familiar with their own situation, and they understand how it works. That there are people in charge, and usually at the top, there's a person in charge. In his day, of course, or this day, it was Caesar. Then on other occasions, it'd be people like, different kings, even in Judea, where they were living, of course, there were still two Herods that were ruling. There were individuals, we might call them for our way of understanding, governors that were installed and answerable to Caesar. Pilate being one, and there'd be others as well that would be, so they understood how that worked. They understood how it worked in Judaism. You had the high priest, and you had the Sanhedrin, the Jewish high court. So they're very familiar with the kingdoms of the world. What they're not familiar with is how it works in God's kingdom. God's kingdom is inverted. In other words, it's not set up where it goes up to the top, and the higher you are in the hierarchy, the more power and authority you have. It's actually turned upside down. That's where Jesus says these things that we've already seen a few, we'll see more. The first will be last, the last will be first. That the servant is the one who has the highest rank. And it's mind-boggling because we do not have that kind of frame of reference. Even Christian denominations and groups will still follow a hierarchical system. And Jesus tells them, and not here, but he will in another place, that's not the way it's going to be among you. That's not the way it's going to work. So they were struggling with that. So they asked a simple question. At that time, the disciples came to him saying, "Who then is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" Okay, tell me. Let us know. James and John are going to try to jockey for the two most powerful places, the right hand and the left hand. They're familiar with that kind of authority that some get. But Jesus surprises them. You got to kind of see this in a very... If you can kind of imagine this, there's all kinds of people around still. The disciples are the ones asking this question. The disciples include the 12, but could also expand to others as well that are gathered there. So they're curious about this. How's this going to work? They are beginning to put the pieces together that he is a Messiah, that he is the Christ. So with that information in mind, it makes sense. How is this going to work in your kingdom? So what he does is he gives them an object lesson. We used to do, years ago, children's sermons. Mm-hmm. And I think adults paid more close attention to the children's sermons than the children did. But an object lesson can carry a lot of punch. So Jesus uses one. Then Jesus called a little child, not just simply a child, but a little child, a small child, and set him in the midst of them. And he said, "Assuredly I say to you, unless you are converted or you turn back and become as little children, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven." Now that's shock. You see, now it's not that children were unimportant, but they weren't considered majorly important. If you looked at at the social structure even of that day, when you would find children, children are down at the bottom. I don't know. A couple of you might remember Little Jimmy Dickens. Anybody remember Little Jimmy Dickens? Take an old cold tater and wait. Remember that song? Well, you see, the way the structure worked, it's not like our culture. Our culture is driven by children. Walmart knows what they're doing, putting the candy bars at the checkout line. They know exactly what they're doing. They know what they're doing when they display toys in certain areas. They know exactly what they are doing in their marketing. Because they'll get a little darling in there that will pitch a fit. Just to shut them up, you'll buy it. Sometimes. Well, that it wasn't, if you ever understand how much of the economy can be run by children, you'd be surprised. I mean, we're talking billions of dollars. Usually targeting, many things are targeting 13-year-old girls because they have a lot of expendable income, but that's another story. That's not like this in the first century. The men ate. Then the women would eat, and children would eat. But children weren't in the forefront. They didn't really have rights, as we think about rights. They just didn't. They weren't considered... As a matter of fact, in the Greco-Roman culture, many times slaves had more rights than children to a certain age. Once they became of age, an age set by the father, then things would change, of course. In the Roman culture, a father could look at his newborn, and maybe there's a birthmark or something, or maybe a defect of some sort. And he'd decide right there whether the child lives or dies. And no one said a word. No one would say a word. Matter of fact, it was so culturally embraced that children dying of exposure was a common sight. Matter of fact, early Christians, the precursor actually to orphanages, Christians later than this, but toward the close of the first century into the second and even to the third, would collect these children that were abandoned and raise them as their own children. So what I'm saying is a child has no rights. And culturally speaking, has very little value in the broader scheme of things. Now, I want you to keep that in mind because you can almost understand almost a sucking noise coming from these disciples as their mouth are gasping open because Jesus gets a child, a little child, sets them in right there where they can see this child, and he tells them, unless you are converted, unless you turn back, like this child, you're worried about who's going to be greatest in the kingdom? You're not even going to get into the kingdom unless you're like this. Now, that was a major, major blow for them trying to understand what Jesus is talking about. He follows up. Therefore, whoever humbles himself as a little child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Now you know the answer. Whoever receives one little child like this in my name receives me. So what is he saying? What kind of model or paradigm is he giving there to those people that are his disciples when they're trying to figure this out? Oh, they're looking for who's going to be the greatest, but they're thinking about an earthly kingdom. They were thinking probably Jesus is on top, and then it would stair-step down the kind of authority and positions of power that his followers would have, especially his 12, the disciples and apostles. And he turns that upside down and says, oh, wait, whoa, 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 whoa. Let me show you what greatness looks like in the kingdom. Here's a child with no rights. Here's a child that will not survive without someone taking care of him. Here's a child that cannot even find food for himself without his parents being the ones who are the source of it. Here's a child who's basically, functionally, helpless. without depending on someone else for his very life. That's what you've got to be. That's what you've got to become. You have to become like that. And then he points out, this is whoever humbles himself, you have to humble yourself. And become like, not childish, not someone who pitches a fit because he or she doesn't get their way or things don't go their way, but you really are not claiming anything for yourself. Now, humility is a slippery term. Why is it? Because if you think you have it, you don't. That's the thing about humility. You know, you might find, and I've met people that over the years, I can think of a couple off the top of my head, but that they were actually proud of their humility, which is more than just an oxymoron. It is an absolute contradiction. Yeah, I'm a humble person and I'm proud of it. But basically, if you are aware of or think of yourself as being humble, you have just lost your humility. It's not that a humble person thinks little of themselves. You know, nobody loves me, everybody hates me, I'm going to go eat worms. You know, that kind of thing. Or I just hate myself because of that, whatever. That's not humility. Humility is not thinking little of yourself. Humility is not thinking about yourself at all. That's humility. And Jesus is elevating humility to the very top. This is what's great. You begin understanding why the disciples now are scratching their heads, most likely trying to figure out, now, how is that going to work? How do you have a kingdom that you don't have the powerful and the influential in charge? You have those that don't even think about their own welfare. That's the kind of people that find themselves great. And then Jesus shifts. He shifts in verse 6 and following, about offenses. Now, he's just talked about... Now, there's two things in view here. And it may not be very clear as we work our way down through here, which is Jesus referring to. Now, he's dealing with the question, what greatness in the kingdom look like? A humble child. First. But then he's talking to his disciples who are adults and using an example, an object lesson of a child there in front of them. So he's going to begin talking now about offenses. Is he talking in reference to children? Or is he talking in reference to his followers? Or perhaps both. You'll see what I mean, I think, when we begin getting in here. But whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him to have a millstone hung around his neck and he were drowned in the depth of the sea. Now, a millstone was something that the disciples and people of that era would have understood very, very clearly. They're very large. They're very heavy. As a matter of fact, they're called a Gethsemane, if you wonder what they actually were referred to. And they were used to grind, but they also they were used to smash. And these stones were very, very heavy. One form of execution was that the executee, the person who's being executed, would be laid flat, and he would begin stacking these stones on his chest. Until, of course, he could no longer breathe and it would crush him. That was one method of crucifixion. I mean, not crucifixion, but execution. So he begins by, you know, you're not going to swim with a millstone around your neck. You're going to drop like a rock. You're going to go all the way to the bottom. And he said, it'd be better if you cause one of these little ones who believe in me to sin. Now, is he referring to children? Traditionally, that's kind of the idea. Maybe he's talking about children. Or is he talking about maybe new believers? And he just refers to them with the metaphor of little children. I would kind of lean toward that perspective as what Jesus is referring to. So he's telling his followers, there are going to be these new converts. And you need to be very careful about how you deal with these new converts. Because if you would cause one of these to sin who believe in me, it would be better for you to have a millstone hung around your neck and dropped into the sea. Woe to the world because of offenses. For offenses will come. But woe to the man by whom the offenses come. Now this puts a tremendous burden, or a great responsibility on those who teach and have leadership positions in churches, whether it's Sunday school, all the way from the little ones, all the way through all the ages. Because what you give people, what you lead people to understand, could very well derail their faith. And you better be careful. Later, James warns about, everyone shouldn't, desire to teach, because the one who teaches will have a greater judgment. This is what's horrifying today in Christianity. When you look at a lot of very well-known, apparently to some degree influential, I'm using air quotes, Christian leaders, that you will find or find out things about them that they are in trouble because of some sort of scandal in their ministry, in their lives. And those that teach falsehoods, maybe it's not scandals, but it's falsehoods. And it's not that you have to be nitpicky. There are differences of opinion and interpretation on certain things. But there are certain things that are just downright heresy. Just downright heresy. And there are some perpetrators of that are very, very wealthy Christian leaders. The kind that fall kind of wake people up. But those that perpetually and continually dabble with false teaching, they have no idea what's waiting at the end of the road for them. If they did, they would cease immediately. So you have that. And Jesus even uses the word woe. It's more akin to a groan than a word. We're going to get that woe again in chapter 23. When he's talking about the scribes, the Pharisees, the hypocrites. There's about seven woes there that he deals with. Let's go a little bit further. If your hand or your foot causes you to sin. Now, we've seen these words before. Different word order, but we've seen this before in the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus said this. If your hand or your foot causes you to sin, cut it off and cast it from you. It is better that for you to enter into life lame and maimed rather than having two hands and two feet and be cast into everlasting fire. And if your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you. It is better for you to enter into life with one eye rather than having two eyes and be cast into hellfire. It's the same thing. Same word as we just read, everlasting fire and hellfire. Again, Jesus uses a word picture here, one that those who are listening to him vividly understand. We don't, because we didn't live in first century Jerusalem, and so we're not keen aware of that. Outside, today it's a park, and it's inside of the city of Jerusalem. In Jesus' day, and in this day, it was this outside of Jerusalem, and it was a place called the Valley of Hinnom, or Hinnom. And there in the Valley of Hinnom, something took place, a few hundred years, about 500 or 600 years actually, prior to this time, where a king named Manasseh, who was the longest reigning king for 55 years, instituted the most vile form of paganism. It included child sacrifice. It was to the god Molech, and he even offered his own children. And I won't get into the details other than to simply say that I don't know if there's anything more abhorrent to God than child sacrifice. It's kind of cloaked for us because you may remember in the Old Testament there's these passages, you will not make your children pass through the fire. Well, that's a Hebraic expression. It's talking about child sacrifice. You will not do that. It's abhorrent to the Lord. So Manasseh instituted it. And where did he institute it? In the Valley of Hinnom. And there in that area, it's a valley. And it's not a deep valley. It's just it's kind of flat, and it's got hills on both sides. And that's where child sacrifice came through. Later in history, individuals in Jerusalem wanted to make sure that would never, ever, ever be used in any kind of religious significance again. So it became a garbage dump. So when you find dead animals, you'd take them and you'd throw them out there. Sometimes a vagrant that had no one to care for them, if they would die, their corpse would be deposited out there in the Valley of Hinnom. Your garbage, your junk, whatever it would be that wasn't worth keeping or using, you would take it out and you would dump it. It was a horrible place. It smelled bad at all times because of decaying animals and other things that were rotting there. It was on fire a lot, because there would be attempts to burn some of it, but it was always smoldering and smoke. And that's why we find in Mark's Gospel, Jesus saying, where the worm doesn't die and the fire is not quenched. What kind of worms? Fishing worms? Night crawlers? Maggots. That's what he's talking about. So it was a very distasteful place. A horrid place. And that's the picture that he uses. Sin is so bad that whatever you have to do to avoid it, avoid it. And of course, he's using what's called hyperbole or overstatement to emphasize the point. If it's your right hand, whack that thing off. If it's your eye, gorge that thing out. Better. Now, I don't... You might... Not, you probably do pretty good without maybe a hand. But how many people would sacrifice an eye? Your hearing, would you choose between your sight or your hearing? Most everyone as sighted would go for sight. Well, anyway, that's the emphasis. It's that bad. Now he's going to shift now, moving from that context to the idea now of a lost sheep. But before I get to there, you have comments or questions or observations or anything you can add to the first 9 verses that we've looked at? Okay, all minds are clear, we'll plow on. Take heed that you do not despise one of these little ones. For I say to you that in heaven their angels always see the face of my Father who is in heaven. For the Son of Man has come to save that which is lost. Now verse 11, if you're using some other translations, you may notice that it's absent. And it may appear in a footnote at the bottom of your page or somewhere, maybe in the margin of your page. What it is, it's one of those passages that the earliest codexes or New Testaments seem to not include. And all it is that. Is this verse in any way, does it change the meaning? And the answer is no. As a matter of fact, you will find Jesus saying that in other places. So it doesn't change anything. As a matter of fact, when you begin comparing translations, it's not that there's a few differences. The amazing thing is that they're so close. I mean, seriously, we're talking about, like, I'm reading the New King James Version. This translation relies on a Greek, or actually it's about seven Greek manuscripts that go back into about the Middle Ages, about 1000 AD, 1200 in through there. Okay? 1,000 years or 1,200 years from the original is a long time, is it not? You would expect that if skeptics were correct, there would be major differences. But there's not. There's not. It's quite interesting, too, to show you how God has preserved His Word. That in the Qumran, that is the Dead Sea Scrolls, probably everybody's heard about those, 1947, there was the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered. Well, among those scrolls, there was a complete, total scroll of Isaiah. Okay? This is remarkable. Matter of fact, if you go to the museum in Jerusalem, you will find that right in the center, there is the scroll. It's of course, a copy of the original that they found. And it goes all the way around. It's well over 50 feet long because it's a scroll. You know, what? It's 1,000 years older than the oldest copy of Isaiah. Are you with me now? The scroll of that is 1,000 years older, found in Qumran, and the oldest scroll up to that point of Isaiah are almost identical. That is remarkable. The only differences are minor things like spelling differences. There's no dictionary, so there's no standard spelling. And there are just only a few of those. It is absolutely remarkable. It's remarkable that, that much time can pass and then still be that accurate. So, whatever Bible translation is a reputable one, you're okay. You really are. You don't have to worry with it. Yes?
How do they know that it was 1,000 years old?
By dating it. There's a certain kind of dating they could do. One, they can date the material that's written on. They also can date other kind of things along with it, like, for example, fauna or just, plant matter. They can carbon-14, those kind of things. Carbon-14 only works on living things. So when you hear someone talk about, well, they found this rock and the carbon-14, no, they didn't. Because a rock is not a living thing. It can't do that. Carbon-14, you're breathing it in. And every living creature is. Even trees have carbon-14 in them. What happens is when the animal or the person or the tree dies, it no longer takes in carbon. So carbon-14 decays at a certain rate. They know exactly how much it decays. Matter of fact, you cannot go back over 60,000 years with carbon-14. And many will argue not even that far back. So anyway, so they can do that kind of thing to date it. And there's certain kind of things too. They can date, interestingly enough, those that study this kind of stuff, they can date a lot of documents from the antiquity by looking at the formulation of letters, how they're written. Because letters, well, just like in English, if you go back and look at really old English and then look at it today, you can see the way letters are made are different. So there's a change in that. So they can, that's also a method of dating. So Anyway, probably enough of that. What do you think? If a man had 100 sheep and one of them goes astray, does he not leave the 99 and go into the mountain to seek the one that is straying? And if he should find it, assuredly I say to you, he rejoices more over that sheep than over the 99 that did not go astray. Even so it is not the will of your Father who's in heaven that one of these little ones should perish. So the first 14 verses, he's still dealing with that theme that he already raised with the disciples. And he talks about those that go astray. Now, when we get to this point, you begin seeing that, well, he's not talking about children. He's not talking about, he didn't say lambs, he said sheep. He's talking about adult. And he's talking about those that wander off. That they started with following him, but for some reason now they've wandered off. It's really a good picture. I've mentioned to you on various occasions, we're not being paid any kind of compliment being compared to sheep. Sheep are basically stupid. And I know that sounds pretty harsh, but I mean that. They're not an animal that can defend itself. They really are not able to do that very effectively. They're also, they can be stubborn. And a sheep, when you, a lot of times when we, do you like the passage that he makes me lie down in green pastures and leave you beside still waters? When I was growing up, I thought, the image that was in my head when I read that was a field of alfalfa. Nice and green and tall, and you can see how, and then later I learned, and then I actually eventually saw those pasture lands. At a distance, you don't see any grass. I mean, you don't see it. It looks barren. Now, when you get closer, you will find that there are sprigs of grass that are growing up, usually around rocks. Not out in the open by themselves, but usually around rocks. And it's not even a full mouthful. That's where David spent most of his time. That, to him, was a green pasture. There was enough there for the, after a period of time, for the sheep to eat and be satisfied. And it took a while for that to happen. But what happened with that sparse grass growing, plant life, a sheep, if it wasn't, you know, kept close by the shepherd, it would graze here, and it would go over here, and it would go over there, and eventually, before you know it, it's lost sight of the flock. And as bright as they are, they don't know how to find their way back. You know, if you have a good dog, you can dump him out anywhere, and he'll find his way home. Now, we have a dog right now that couldn't. But growing up, our dogs could. I mean, we could dump them out, and they'd find their way home. One of my coon hound, his name was Rojo. I named him after Archie Campbell's rooster. I don't know if you remember that song or not. I know I'm dating myself by that, but Rojo, he was a good coon hound. Anyway, I hopped in to pick up one Friday night by myself, and I was going to go watch a ball game at Forsyth, Missouri. I just drove my dad's pickup, so I hopped in there, and I'm going down there, and I drive about 10 miles, and I look in the rearview mirror, and guess what I see? Rojo. He thought we were going coon hunting. So there he was in the back. Now, what am I going to do with that dog for the next 2.5 hours when watching these ball games? So I turn around, I drive back, and I stop about 5 miles away from my house, and I jump him out, and I drive off. And I don't remember the ball game because I was worried about my dog. I was just worried about him. Am I going to lose him forever now? And so I hurried home after the game, went to the doghouse, and guess what was inside the doghouse? Sheep don't do that. Sheep don't do that. They don't have any good direction. So a sheep would wander off. Now, sheep were important. I mean, you lived off of what, you know, a sheep produces. Not only lambs, but it's wool and whatnot. So all that's important. So if you lose one, you want to, especially when you don't have very many, you're going to go look for it. That's what he's pointing out. And what is he saying? Well, when we have people that are genuine Christians, but they wander off, what do we do? Do we say, good riddance? Figure it out on your own? No, there is a sense where we should pursue them. Now, I can't say I've been a successful pursuer. Because a lot of times there's other issues going on. But at least, you know, Jesus points out their value. Their value. So now it seems like he obviously is talking about new converts and how important they are in the kingdom. Verse 15, we take a shift. Moreover, if your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. If he hears you, you have gained your brother. Okay? So how do we handle conflict? How do we handle offenses between individuals? It very, 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 very rarely will anybody, especially in our case, Christians, they won't follow this. They will sell up or quit going because they got their feelings hurt or they've been offended for whatever reason. That's what happens. That's not what Jesus says to do. If your brother sins against you, he's offended you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. It's possible he doesn't even know he's offended you. It may not even be what he said or what he meant or what he did. It may just be the way you took it. Did you ever take something the wrong way? Sure. We're human, right? So what do you do about it? Well, that's what you do. You approach the person. They may not even be aware. And if they are aware, you need to go tell them, hey, this is the issue. And if you do that, maybe it can be reconciled right there. Everything's fine. You can just move on. But if he will not hear, take with you two or more, and by the mouth of two or three witnesses, let every word be established. So now it's bigger. It's bigger. You go to him, and you know, whatever the offense might be, maybe you have loaned him something and he hasn't returned it. This is hypothetical, okay? Just a thought. And he hadn't returned it, and you go and you ask for it, and he says, well, for some reason he doesn't give it back. So you take two or three others, you know, a couple more people with you, and you go there and you say, well, you need to return this because you take it, he loaned it to you in good faith, you need to return it. And if he listens, good. Now what happens if he doesn't listen? What if he just refuses? Well, let's go on a bit further. And if he refuses to hear them, tell it to the church. Second use of the word church in the Matthew's Gospel. But if he refuses even to hear the church, let him be to you like a heathen and a tax collector. Okay? So if he doesn't listen to the church, he is now he's obviously out of fellowship. Not only with the person who's offended, but also now it is now the entire group. Where I was, my first pastorate was a church that had a long, rich history. And while I was there, we had an anniversary thing for them, for that church. And someone broke out the minutes from past business meetings. I'm talking about meetings 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. Reading those was really a hoot. It was really a hoot. I can't remember all the details, but I remember this one. In one I was reading, it's during a business meeting, it said that brother so-and-so was seen at a dance. Doesn't say who saw him. That's interesting. He was seen at a dance, and the church voted to withdraw. This is what it said. Literally it said this. The church voted to withdraw the right hand of fellowship from brother so-and-so. And then in a couple of more months, there was an entry into the minutes. Brother so-and-so has said he's sorry for going to the dance, and the right hand of fellowship was once again extended to him, or something to that effect. So that it was how they understood at that time church discipline. This is the passage that deals with church discipline. Church discipline is seldom ever practiced. And you know why? Because most Christians are too immature for you to properly administer church discipline. Can't do it. Because all you end up with is a fight. You have hurt feelings. You have ugly things said. And people do not give one bit of concern to what God has said. I mean, I know I'm saying that pretty strongly. But I've been there, done that. And I've got the scars to prove it. And on one occasion, it wasn't even church discipline. It was going to lead to that, but didn't have opportunity to go that far. We had, in Arkansas, we had a woman that had moved back into her parents' house. She and her husband had divorced. He was an adulterer, so she had valid grounds for the divorce. Well, she's a young woman. I don't remember how old she was at the time. Guesstimation, 25 to 27 is her age, or was her age at the time. Well, and she was also working with our youth. And we didn't have, but, you know, a handful of youth, but we had some kids that she was working with. Well, the kids talked because they were aware of some of the things going on in this woman's life that I or no one else was. And of course, at this time, I'm still in the dark. Literally, I'm in the dark with this. I didn't know what was going on. Well, one of the ladies in our congregation was a hairdresser, you know, and a beautician. And these kids, for some reason, would talk to her. They talked to her about everything. Anyway, these kids started telling what their Sunday school teacher was doing. At what she was involved in, so this woman was vexed in conscience. So one Sunday morning, I kid you not, one Sunday morning after the morning worship service, she asked me, "Would you and Tanya be in your office? I need to say something." Okay, I go there. I'm kind of leaning up against my desk, and Tanya's in there. And this woman's name was Mary. And Mary said, "Tanya, the kids are telling these kind of things about what you're involved in. And if it's true, you know, she was calling her to repent." Now, I'm sitting, of course, you know, I don't know whether to spit or wind my watch. I don't know what I'm doing right there at this moment. Well, it didn't go well. Tanya didn't like being told that her involvement in strip poker and that kind of thing was not something that a Sunday school teacher ought to be doing. So she left in a huff. I kid you not, I walk from the church to the parsonage, and it's about 125 feet. When I walk into the house, my phone's ringing. It's Grandma. And Grandma is fit to be tied. Then Mom calls me. She's fit to be tied. So we have a lot of family in this church, you know. And then the deacon chairman calls me. He's fit to be tied. What makes that woman think she can call this other person's behavior on the... I'm just overwhelmed with this. Because what was done was right, but the response was wrong. Now, the thing of it is, grandma, mom, deacon chairman, they had no idea what was said in that room. Only three of us knew what was said in that room. Now, I was very naive in my response because I didn't know how to handle this fire that just suddenly erupted. It exploded, actually. Now, other people were involved in it, and they thought it should be. I'm still thinking, you know, I need to hold confidences. I need to make sure people know they can trust me with the most delicate things. So I didn't say anything other than, maybe there's things that need to be worked out here. Well, it wasn't going to be worked out. Now, today, what would I do? I'd walk to the pulpit and tell everybody what happened, what was said, and what was going on. Then I'd pack my bags. But that's what I would do. There is no sense, that kind of stuff. And what was overwhelming to me was how many years these people had been in church, supposedly studying the Bible, and they had no clue of what God had said to do about a conflict like that. No clue. More comes. Assuredly, I say to you, verse 18, whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. Now, it's interesting. We've heard those words before in chapter 16, right? And that's where our Catholic friends say, that Peter is the first pope because he was given the keys to the kingdom and the power of binding and loosing. Well, it's not Peter in view here. It's all of them in view here. And he's talking about the church. Remember? If he refuses to hear, tell it to the church. Assuredly, I tell you, the church, talking about the authority of the local church, binding and loosing. And in verse 19, now this is where I would submit to you is a major misunderstanding. Not necessarily a misapplication, but a misunderstanding. Again, I say to you, that if two of you agree on earth concerning anything that they ask, it will be done for them by my Father in heaven. For where two or three are gathered together in my name, I am in their midst. Now, most of the time, it is used, if there's a few of us in number, that's okay because God is in our midst. That's not necessarily a misapplication, but it is a wrong interpretation. That's not what it's talking about. Well, how so? Well, verse 19 begins with, again. Now, if it's again, what does that mean? It's a continuation of what he's been already saying. So what he's saying here, he's talking about church discipline. When the church comes together, I am in your midst. I will be in the midst guiding you in this process. And let me hasten to add something else before our time flees. When it says you treat him like a pagan or a heathen and a tax collector, that doesn't mean now that you cut ties with him. What it means is now you try to evangelize him. Because maybe he isn't a genuine brother. If he refuses to listen to the church, with the church reaching out in love and redemptively, if he refuses that, perhaps he's not a brother. So what you should do now is you have to reach out to him. One more story and then we'll break. All right? This was in Cahokia. The chairman of the search committee, also a deacon, and he was the son of the former pastor. Okay, so he grew up in the church there. He was the one that I did most of my contact with when we were talking back and forth whether we would come there or not, that kind of thing. And anyway, so we did. We moved there, and he was kind of he was older than I am, but not a lot older. We're talking when we're within about 7 years of age. So he became somewhat of a closer friend, that kind of thing. He and his wife, his wife is a dear friend even to this day. Well, she was one in charge of our preschool, and I noticed her that his name was Stan. I noticed Stan was acting kind of different. And he had neck surgery, and they used cadaver bone. You know, that's pretty common. You know, they use that. And I was teasing him because of the way he was acting. Maybe it was from a biker. You know, I just teasing. I had no idea. You know, and so I thought maybe he was. You know, I'm teasing about that. He kind of just started acting different. Well, his wife one day came up. The tears dripping down her cheeks, said, "Well, something's really wrong." I said, she said, "Stan wants to take a vacation by himself." I said, "Okay." And she said she looked at the ticket, or she could able, she's be able to access the ticket somehow, and it was a ticket that said, "And friends fly free." Is what promotion back in that day. Oh. So, I know where Stan worked. He was an accountant, and he worked in the East St. Louis school district. And so I drove up to the district building there for the school system there. I walk in, there's a security guard. This was kind of, to me it was funny. I don't know if you find it funny or not. I come in, and I talk to the security guard. And I said, "I'm here to see," you know, I told the guy's name. And he went on the phone, and I'll never forget what he said. He said, he called me by name and said, "Hey, there's some white guy out here who wants to see you." East St. Louis, okay. So I was somewhat of an oddity, even in that building. So I went back and I asked him, I said, "Stan, is this true? What's going on?" He confessed. He confessed. And then I asked him to resign everything that he had in the church. He had a girlfriend. He was it's adulterous, so it wasn't just a friend. It was an adulterous situation. So I asked him to resign everything. And he did. He even wrote up a letter. Then I told the deacons, and the deacons were just devastated because they watched him grow up in church. You know, they saw him all those formative years. And then Stan made a request. He wanted us to remove him from membership of the church. I told the deacons, "No, we're going to decline his request." Now, this is my reasoning. If we cut ties with him, we would no longer really have any kind of authority to reach out to him. So that was my thinking, anyway. So time went on, and one Sunday morning, it was probably in a few weeks of the initial shock of everything, Stan came to church. He came to the front, offered repentance. I thought, man, this really works. I mean, I went to him, I talked to him, and he's doing it. And so I was walking on cloud nine. I thought, man, this is supernatural. The next morning, his father-in-law came in to my office, wanted to talk to him in and sit down and said, "Well," he talked about his daughter. "She co-signed a loan to buy a car, and now he's gone." And I thought, that rascal, he lied like a dog to me and everyone else. He came back so he could get a new car. Anyway, so I've not been very successful at church discipline, just so you know. And so that's 0 for 2. There's been a couple of other close calls that probably would be maybe foul balls, but
You've already got us depressing.
I know, but it was. But as painful as it all this was, there is a positive kind of subscript or footnote, and it's this: when you do what God says to do, even if it doesn't come to the conclusion that you desire for it to come to, you're still faithful. You're faithful. Maybe you're faithful as a failure, but at least you're still faithful. So this whole thing, even though we apply it to prayer or just two or three meeting together, mainly prayer, I'm not saying it's a bad application, but the interpretation would demand that we focus in on church discipline, because that's the point. That's the point. That's what he's talking about. Now, next time we're going to move to the parable of the unforgiving servant, and probably then follow that up with marriage and divorce and what Jesus says here about it. We've already met it before in the Sermon on the Mount, but we'll look at it again. Any concluding thoughts? Well, you've been very, very attentive tonight. Very good, you know. No one challenged me for my blunders, so I appreciate that mercy and that grace. Let me invite you to bow. We'll pray and we'll be dismissed. Father, thank you for your word. And we sometimes approach your word very like a pragmatist. We think if we follow this recipe, everything is going to turn out just like we want it to. When at times the issue is our being faithful, not necessarily being successful. Help us understand that. Because too many of us, pastors included, that if things don't go the way we would like for them to, or if the result is not the desired result, we think that, oh, we failed and somehow your word has failed, when that's not true. It's not true at all. You grant us a measure of freedom. The choices that we make, the repercussions and the consequences that come, you grant us these things. And we would not be free if there was not choices that we could make that are the wrong ones. But thank you for helping us understand a little more about your kingdom. And I pray that as we depart, we'll do so not only under your blessing, though we do ask that, but that our hearts will desire to be faithful. For these things we ask in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you much.